Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. You also get access to ad-free versions of the podcast. We recently released a bonus episode on the Shrektroversy that I created on its 20th anniversary, and we have another one in the works about the major streaming services and how each of them serve movie lovers. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps
and Genevieve Kosky.
Tasha is doing a walkabout, but we presume she'll find her way back for the next set of episodes. I'm happy to report that we have started going to the movies again. The Walter Murch edit of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil was my first time back, and can testify to the absolute pleasure of the experience, which I hope to never take for granted again. And yet, we again picked a new movie that you can find on VOD as well as theaters because quarantainment is kind of here to stay. Nevertheless, as this week's classic movie demonstrates, it's a great time to go outside and have a picnic at a beautiful, secluded, rural locale.
Oh, no. You did it again, Scott.
Did what again?
How much of Picnic at Hanging Rock did you actually watch? Like, what happens in Picnic at Hanging Rock?
Well, a bunch of private school girls go on a field trip on Valentine's Day. A few go off on their own up the titular rock. Everyone has a nice nap. You know, it's one of those movies where not much happens, but it's very beautiful. Look out. Peter Weir, great director, very underrated. He loves making movies outside.
You also took a nice nap, didn't you?
I admit I drifted in and out, but I think I got the gist of it.
Scott, you did not get the gist of it. Come on, this is a professional podcast. Our listeners count on us to see the movies we're talking about on the show. It's the least you can do. You can't bluff your way through that.
Well, I think this is one of the seminal works of the Australian New Wave. Don't you agree? Where would you put this in your Peter Weir rankings? Better or worse than Gallipoli?
No, you're not going to get out of this through empty superlatives and list-making, Scott.
But that's how I've done my job for years. Fine. I'll watch the last hour and 20 minutes of the film. Just hang tight, everyone, and talk amongst yourselves. Wow. Okay. Jeez, man. That was a lot more eventful than I assumed. Perhaps people should continue to stay inside after all. Seems dangerous out there. Keith, what are we looking at this week?
We are venturing to rural Australia for two films about unsolved mysteries and the effect they have on survivors. First up is Picnic at Hanging Rock, Peter Weir's 1975 breakthrough about three schoolgirls and a teacher who disappear without a trace one afternoon, leaving an entire community to obsess, perhaps forever, about what happened to them. Based on Joan Lindsay's novel, the film is loaded with symbols and suggestion, but short on easy answers, which invites the audience to fill in the blanks. Our second film, The Dry, is a much more conventional thriller about the convergence of two tragic events separated by over 20 years, with Eric Bana as a federal agent who returns to his drought-plagued hometown after a triple homicide, only to find himself under scrutiny from the townspeople.
So this week, we'll hop into the minivan of carriages and head out for a picnic at Hanging Rock. Then next week, we'll watch the sparks fly in the tinderbox landscape of The Dry. Please join us.
Good morning, girls.
Good morning, Mrs. Appenbrough.
Well, young ladies, we are indeed fortunate in the weather for our picnic to Hanging Rock. I have instructed Mademoiselle that as the day is likely to be warm, you may remove your gloves once the drag has passed through Wood End. You will partake of luncheon at the picnic grounds near the rock. Once again, let me remind you, the rock itself is extremely dangerous. You are therefore forbidden any tomboy foolishness in the matter of exploration, even on the lower slopes.
Miranda! Miranda! Miranda, don't go on there! Come back!
What we see and what we seem are but a dream. A dream within a dream. With that piece of narration at the beginning of Picnic at Hanging Rock, his adaptation of John Lindsay's novel, director Peter Weir is telling the audience what kind of movie to expect. and yet it still feels radical anyway. As consumers of fiction, and as moviegoers especially, we have to have our questions answered. If something gets set up, then it must get paid off. To have a mystery that's unsolvable is a shock to the system, and it elicits an almost visceral reaction, much like the scene toward the end of the film when a girl is attacked by her classmates for not giving them the information they desperately need to know. Picnic at Hanging Rock is the type of material that's typically resistant to screen adaptation. Film typically rewards lean, muscular narratives and satisfying conclusions. It doesn't so easily accommodate internal voices or abstraction, much less the heresies of intentional ambiguity. It also requires a special filmmaker to pull it off, someone with the ability to harness film's potential for symbolism and suggestion rather than literal-mindedness. And with this film, only his second after The Cars That Ate Paris, Weir set the standard for a new wave of Australian cinema that defied convention and turned the untamed landscape of the country itself into a primary character. So here's what definitely happens in Picnic at Hanging Rock. Almost definitely, anyway. On Valentine's Day 1900, a group of students from Appleyard College, a strict all-girls school in Victoria, are taken by buggy for an outing at Hanging Rock, a remote geological formation deep into the countryside. Once they arrive at their destination, four students, led by the lovely yet eerily serene Miranda, strike out on their own to climb up the rock. They fall asleep. When they wake up, three of the four remove their shoes and tights and walk barefoot through a crevasse, never to be seen again. The fourth comes screaming down the rock while a teacher, Miss McCraw, is spotted ascending the rock herself, also never to be seen again. The disappearance rattles the community. A student named Sarah, an orphan who is not allowed to join the picnic, is particularly crestfallen because of her infatuation with Miranda. The strict headmistress, Mrs. Appleyard, is dealing with frightened students and a wave of parents who want to pull them from school. A young man named Michael, who witnesses the girls' ascent that day, becomes so obsessed with finding them that he nearly dies trying. And when one of the missing girls comes back, she cannot remember a single thing that happened. Picnic at Hanging Rock does not solve this mystery. There are no bodies to find and no trail to follow. And in the closing minutes, we're left to scratch our chins some more over an incident involving Sarah and Mrs. Appleyard. What we're left with is an allegorical coming-of-age story, with these missing girls choosing to reject the tight harnessing of their dresses and their souls and follow this alluring, scary, mesmeric passage into womanhood. Beyond the sensual wildness of the natural setting, with its poisonous ants and venomous snakes, Weir isn't shy about emphasizing phallic and vaginal imagery, or the power a sexually confident woman like Miranda wields over both Sarah and Michael. The irony is that death, such as it goes, becomes associated with Appleyard College more than whatever happened at Hanging Rock. Sarah is not fortunate not to have gone to the picnic. She's merely left behind. The traditions that Mrs. Appleyard is trying to uphold at the school are arbitrary and cruel and destructive, alienating both students and teachers. And as the school withers away on the vine, there's a literal death at the end, and Mrs. Appleyard is discovered in her office in full mourning attire. Watching Picnic at Hanging Rock this time, I was reminded of a bit of narration from Adam O'Goyen's The Sweet Hereafter, a film about a small town that loses most of its children in a bus accident. The narration goes, quote, "We're all citizens of a different town now, a place with its own special rules, its own special laws," end quote. The film seemed to share an idea about a tragic event as a catalyst for change. Communities are reshaped and reformed into something else. Girls are not girls forever. Places like Appleyard College cannot stay the same, and the 20th century is not going to be like the 19th. Weir captures the feeling of what it's like to be citizens of a different town now.
I hope you've learned your poetry, Sarah. Sit up straight, child. Hold your shoulders back. You're getting a dreadful stoop. Well, have you got your lines by heart? Well, have you?
I can't. It doesn't make sense.
Sense? You little ignoramus. Evidently you don't know that Mrs. Felicia Hemans is considered one of the finest of our English poets.
I know another piece of poetry by heart. It has ever so many verses, much more than The Wreck of the Hesperus. Would that do?
What is the name of this poem?
An Ode to St. Valentine.
I'm not acquainted with it. Where did you find it?
I didn't find it. I wrote it.
You wrote it?
Love abounds. Love surrounds.
No, thank you, Sarah. Strange as it may seem, I still prefer Mrs. Hemans.
So First question, of course, what is your history with Picnic at Hanging Rock, and how does it look in the year 2021?
I've seen this film a bunch of times now, although I don't think I saw it until it was released on DVD by Criterion, whenever that was. But it's a film I have come back to several times. I'm a very, I'm a great admirer of this film. And if you asked me to tell you what was going on or explain it to you, I never could. And that's not really a problem for me.
I'm really afraid to break this to you, but we're going to ask you that stuff.
No, but you know what? I'm very comfortable with this film being one of the sentence of this film never closed. There's no period at the end of it. There's no punctuation. This is it's a film not to be talked about in many ways, but not necessarily one. It resists the sort of the internet era desire to be decoded and understood in that way.
Yeah, I wouldn't even like call it a sentence, because that implies like more structure than I think, you know, is evident here. It's more like, it's kind of like an E.E. Cummings poem, you know, of a movie. But this is a movie I hadn't seen before and have been wanting to catch up with for a long time. I do remember editing your review of it back at the Dissolve, Keith. So you did it at one point explain what happened in it to some extent in review form. But yeah, it was one that I was always really curious and eager to catch up with, in part because I had heard over the years, maybe in that review, maybe elsewhere, that it was a big influence on Sofia Coppola, particularly the Virgin Suicides and Marie Antoinette, which are probably my two favorite Coppola films. Sorry, Lost in Translation, but that's mm-hmm. me. And, you know, I'm a sucker for any movie where women wear gloves and straw hats. So it was, you know, it definitely seemed like a movie that I should see, but it's also a movie that I feel you need to, it invites a certain frame of mind. And here is where I will admit that I was probably not in the best frame of mind for this to be my first viewing of Picnic at Hanging Rock, in part because I was viewing it through the context of this pairing and looking for connections and looking for things to talk about rather than just sitting there and experiencing it. And I think that is almost certainly a better way to experience this film for the first time than, you know, in a sort of like studying capacity. Not that there's nothing there to study, you know, there's certainly a lot of thematic interpretation that your brain kind of has to do as you watch. But, you know, I don't know that I wanted to be doing that thematic interpretation as my first introduction to this film, because it is so beautiful and it is so kind of almost visceral in its appeal and in its horror. You know, I think like this does kind of function as a type of horror film, albeit one that I am very capable of sitting through. But yeah, I think the impulse to graft meaning onto it for the purposes of having a discussion about it kind of makes it more difficult to engage with on that more kind of elemental level that I think this film probably needs.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, in terms of history, I mean, this was one that I saw quite a long time ago. You discover certain movements, you discover the Australian New Wave, and you work your way through some of the major films. And this is, you know, one of the, you know, seminal works of that era and that of Australian cinema. So I was naturally drawn to it, but it has been had been quite a while. And, you know, as far as we'll get into the pairing later, but, you know, after seeing, you know, we kind of did this on a, we had read good reviews of The Dry, and then some of those reviews had mentioned Picnic at Hanging Rock. So it was kind of like, this is it. This is our chance to do Picnic at Hanging Rock. Let's do it. And none of us had actually seen The Dry. And I also, like you, Genevieve, saw The Dry first before I revisited Picnic at Hanging Rock. And, you know, my impression was like, well, you know, there are ways they connect in ways with which they absolutely have nothing in common at all. And in terms of their approach. So I think I was able to abandon that a little bit and kind of mm-hmm. give in a bit to Picnic at Hanging Rock, because Picnic at Hanging Rock is so immediately announces itself as a much more abstract experience right from that opening bit of narration that I mentioned in the keynote. So in any case, I really love this movie. I love movies that are by filmmakers who have the ability to pull off something like this, because this is such a literary conceit. I mean, it is not at all shocking to learn that it's based on a novel. You would assume as much, because it's not, you know, there are not a lot of filmmakers who are that naturally given to this type of abstraction. You know, and I appreciate how much it sticks to it and the feeling that it gives you watching it. It's visceral. I think, Genevieve, you're right in using that word to describe the film, and suggestive. And I find it interesting. Interesting the way that, you know, the action that happens at the Rock, and then also the contrast between that and the action within the school itself, particularly with Sarah and Mrs. Appleyard, and all these very strong themes of repression and liberation and, you know, sexuality. It's all very, it's nice to kind of like consider those ideas in this kind of suggestive way and not in a way that kind of hits you over the head that much.
Yeah, I think maybe more than any pairing we've done or any film we've done in since the pandemic started, like, this is one that I really, really wished I was able to see in a theater. Not that I would have been able to see it in a theater, most likely, if there hadn't been a pandemic. But, like, you know, I think, like, I've gotten pretty good at home viewing and not sort of like letting the fact that I'm watching in my living room, you know, affect my viewing experience too much. But this is one that, like, I really wished I had been able to watch it with the outside world more closed off and been able to just kind of like really zoom in to this like film's wavelength and its sort of dreamy feeling that it's hard to tap into when I'm, you know, watching on my couch while, you know, someone falls asleep next to me.
Well, and it reminds me so much. I mean, you know, it reminds me of the most cinematic movie I can think of, which is 2001: A Space Odyssey. That,
yeah, sure.
You know, the Rock itself, when mm-hmm. we're in its presence, the soundtrack offers up that monolith humming noise, you know, that strange alien thing, which is like, this is more than just an interesting geological outcropping. This is something mysterious and dangerous and transformative. And so, yeah, I mean, it naturally is going to recall a movie like that. And it's, you know, it's so reliant on cinematic effect. You know, I mean, it's not a film it's not a film about the dialogue, and it's not a film, you know, it's not a sentence, it's an ellipses, or however you want to talk about it. And all of that stuff definitely suggests that the big screen would be good. So I've never seen this film.
Yeah.
Projected.
There's so many films that I've never seen projected. I'd love to, and this definitely would be high on that list.
For the sound too, like the like Gallipoli, which we also covered on the podcast and also like talked about, it's an unusual score. Like, this definitely has, I mean, it has some very traditional elements in its score, but it also has some very unusual ones. But there's this sort of, you know, electronic humming that reappears throughout it. And I don't know if it was, you know, the TV I was watching on, or the HBO Max transfer, or maybe that's how it was supposed to be, but it had that like real low end buzz that you get mm-hmm. sometimes, you know. And I, like, it may have been intentional, but I feel like it probably wasn't. And, you know, I think just, again, sort of speaking to what Weir does with like the tools of filmmaking, you know, this is two films now of his that we've done that have very, very interesting soundtracks. And I worry I didn't get the full effect of it watching it on streaming at home.
I have nice speakers. I have like a fancy sound system, except for Ooh. My subwoofer, which is a thing I bought from Radio Shack 20 years ago. And this film was pushing that to the limit.
at times. Wait, you're saying that Radio Shack sold you a disappointing piece of
it was what I could afford at the time, and I've never felt, I'm not such an audiophile that I need to upgrade it, or should I? Readers, let me know, or listeners, let me know.
Oh, I'm sure they will. You know, Weir once said that a potential distributor at a screening for the film threw his coffee cup at the end because it was a mystery without a solution. What was your reaction? Did you feel agitated by not knowing what happened?
I didn't feel agitated or upset, in part because I knew going in that there was no resolution here. I knew that was going to be like sort of the big contrast point in this pairing. So I wasn't like expecting to have the mystery solved. And I think if I was, then I could definitely see having an adverse reaction to the ending here. But I still didn't find the ending, well, to say I didn't find it satisfying kind of feels redundant, but hearing about what happened to Mrs. Appleyard, just like in voiceover at the end, it feels like there's a beat missing, or again, there's that, it's that period, you know, but it's that missing period, or it's that ellipses, but there's like, it feels like there's something really important in that ellipses that we didn't necessarily need you know, dug into in any meaningful way, but I feel maybe could have been presented in a more...
There's a real Poochie died on his way back to his home planet.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It feels very postscripty.
I think that's completely fair, especially because I think that the ending is already so suggestive of death, and we get that shot of or scene of Mrs. Appleyard very mysteriously, mm-hmm. you know, dressed the way she is in her office. I mean, I think that...
I don't even think we needed the postscript of what happened to her. Like, her being catatonic in morning wear with the school that bears her name essentially being a done deal is evocative as death. It's more evocative of death than a voiceover telling us she was found dead.
Yeah. And I wonder if, like, it felt imposed. I haven't read anything to that effect, but it did seem like maybe the distributor, maybe somebody other than Peter Weir was like, you've got to give him something. You've got to give him some piece of information at the end here, just without, about what, what happened to these characters. Even telling the audience that they weren't found would be at least some kind of conclusion. But I think you're right. I don't think putting that piece of information in the voiceover at the end services the film at all, because it does such an elegant job, you know, kind of landing the story where it does for her.
I can't speak to that detailed. I do know that Weir did rework the last act quite a bit. A lot of the stuff with the visions of Miranda, the dream sequence, and the way everyone's kind of seems to be caught up in this sort of this dream state with visions of her was an addition after they screened it the first time, which I don't know what it looked like before, but I do love all that stuff. So I think that was a fine addition. I can't cast my mind back to how I reacted the first time I saw this beyond really liking it, but knowing what I know now, I find, you know, some of the pleasure of the film is watching Weir and the film tease viewers a little bit, like, you know, suggest things that look like they're going to clear something up and then go in another direction. There's a lot of fainting, feint in the way the story is told. I mean, it is kind of darkly playful in a way. If you realize you're not going to get any answers, I think part of the enjoyment comes from knowing that and seeing how it kind of messes with viewers.
Yeah, and it's worth remembering that, you know, this also opens with a card telling us exactly what we're about to see happen mm-hmm. in a very, you know, straightforward and fact-based way, you know. I think that makes me think the sort of voiceover, because it's the detective or cop, constable, I don't know what you even call him here, but it's his voice, right, that says it, I think?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. So, like, having those two very, like, just the facts, ma'am, bookends. Having those as bookends kind of feels like, sort of almost cheeky, move and sort of, suggesting that there's an answer here and then giving us a film where we don't get that answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the other thing too, is that, I mean, obviously the girls who were at the school, the survivors, are stressed out and agitated by this mystery. I mean, everyone who survives is, but I think as viewers we don't necessarily feel like the disappeared have gone to a worse place somehow, you know, like it doesn't seem like their fate is death or worse than death. It feels like it's like it's the opposite of that, or it's more of a, again, sort of change or transition or something. I mean, obviously they're not around, so that yeah, but that's a negative, but you know what I mean? I mean, it doesn't feel, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't feel tragic to us what happens to them, or at least it didn't feel tragic to me.
Yeah, I mean, all the imagery is of ascent and sort of like, you know, getting beyond the earth, and certainly like taking off the stockings, you know, this daring move of taking off the stockings is casting off, a very visible sign of restriction, although one certainly we wouldn't blink twice about today, of course. And that makes the case of Irma so peculiar. Like, wherever it is she was, she's not there anymore and has no memory of it. That whole development is really fascinating to me, and as is the scene where she is publicly shunned by the other girls, just a really scary moment.
Have either of you done any reading up on the excised final chapter of the novel?
Just a little. I knew about this, and I refreshed my memory before this recording, and I know that it existed, and there's a plot description of it on Wikipedia, and I kind of don't want to read it. You know, I kind of whatever it was in my head. Go ahead. You can say it.
I think it's worth bringing up in the context of this question about, like, if the, you know, end of this is satisfying, or how we feel about not knowing what happened. Because, so the story is that Joan Lindsay, who wrote the novel, apparently she always maintained that it came to her in a dream, basically. And she was always, it sounds like, very cagey about the line between fact and fiction in the book. But her publisher, her editor, was the one who suggested taking out the final chapter and letting it end on a note of ambiguity, which I think everyone agrees was the right move. But it was agreed that the final chapter could be published posthumously after Lindsay's death, and it was published as The Secret of Hanging Rock. And so, you know, there was an ending written to this, and I haven't read it in Lindsay's words, nor have I read the original novel, but I did find a summary on the website Little White Lies that I think is worth reading, just as a sort of illustration of what kind of answer we might have gotten here if we desire. So the article on Little White Lies reads, perhaps unsurprisingly, rather than closing the mystery, it opens up another deeper one. The last chapter sees the missing mathematics mistress reappear, a semi-clothed clown woman who the girls don't seem to recognize as their teacher. She speaks in prophetic statements, then transforms herself into a crab and enters a time warp. Two girls willingly follow her into the portal. One remains and returns to the school with no recollection of the fateful afternoon.
That's obviously that's what happened, right?
This is like the Laura Palmer's Diaries all over again, isn't it? Like people need some kind of answer, and so you have this very weird supplemental material that kind of surfaces. So I kind of want to dig into some of the characters a little bit, some of whom are almost, you know, symbolic, and others maybe we can kind of more grasp multidimensionally. But you know, the object of infatuation here is Miranda. What did you make of that character and what she signifies?
I think it's who Sofia Coppola was paying the most attention to when she got inspired for Virgin Suicides. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, she's stunning to look at. She's angelic. She's a Botticelli, you know. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of very attractive people in this movie, and I think maybe in Australia generally, if I may make such a blanket statement.
We love to flatter our Australian listeners.
I think you're jumping to connections too soon.
Yeah, right. Pretty people connection. But, I mean, it's definitely a role that requires more than just being beautiful to look at. I think she has to project a certain sort of remove from the girls around her. Like, even in those opening scenes at the school, when the girls are all kind of giddy and excited for their outing, when Miranda tells Sarah, "You must learn to love someone other than me. I won't be here much longer." You know, like, even like that statement and the way she says it, I feel like immediately kind of places her at this, like I said, a remove, or like she knows something. She has some sort of foreknowledge, or, you know, she's just operating on a different level, an ethereal level, perhaps, you know, that is at that point in very sharp contrast to all the other girls we see, you know, giddy over the Valentine's Day festivities. So, and Weir certainly amps up that feeling and how he films her and all the slow motion and whatnot. But, you know, it's there in the performance too.
I mean, there's this kind of a serene self-confidence to her that she is able to project. And I think she's able to do that because, as that line suggests, she kind of knows what's going to happen, you know, and I think that it's a literal disappearance in the film. But I think we can read it, you know, as this transition into womanhood that in maturity that Sarah is ill-equipped or unable to make with her, to sort of join her in that transition. You know, in a weird way, I was just kind of rethinking this idea of it not being tragic that they disappear because of Miranda seems to know. But I guess maybe the thing that might be tragic about it is that where they're going and what they want to be and what they are transitioning into has no place, you know, in the world in which they live, right? The type of expression that they're showing, the sensuality, it's all very it doesn't fit into a world in which, you know, they're shown, you know, tightening each other's dresses.
Right. Well, and you can see it illustrated again when Irma returns, and once she is, you know, well again and is leaving, and she's like presented to her classmates. Not only is she wearing bright red, which, I mean, I think it doesn't get more symbolic than that if you're viewing this as an allegory about, you know, sexuality or womanhood or variety of related themes there, but the way that the girls react to her, which is basically swarming her and yelling her and resenting her, you know, like she is no longer a part of this world. She can't return to it.
So what about the people who are at Appleyard College who don't go on this trip, particularly Sarah and Mrs. Appleyard? That is more in the realm of conventional drama, right? I mean, what do you make of these characters?
I mean, I loved Mrs. Appleyard's hairdo. not only was it, structural, but I think it was symbolic.
As an aside, the hair has a lot to do with it. How old do you think Rachel Roberts was when she made this movie?
Oh, just because I'm like familiar with how women over the age of 30 get ridiculously aged up in film, I'm going to say my age. I'm going to say 37.
No, older. She's my age. Like, she's like 47, okay. 48, okay. Which is basically also Eric, see, not to jump ahead with the connections, but also Eric Bana's age. The Drive. One is presenting a little more fun than the other.
You're setting us up with a Mama's Family situation. People love it when we make references to Mama's Family. Keith, let's go back to Appleyard College and talk about it.
I think there's a whole drama playing out between Mrs. Appleyard and Sarah that obviously we see the beginning and middle and end of, but almost don't see all the details in between. We don't even know for sure, unless I missed something, why Sarah is held back, other than she is there as a kind of borderline charity case, so she doesn't necessarily get all the French benefits of the college.
I took it more that she was being punished just because of that scene where Mrs. Appleyard was like getting her, or you know, making her memorize a poem or something, and she was, you know, trying to write her own and clearly not being a diligent or respectful student. So it struck me more as a punishment, but also probably one informed by Mrs. Appleyard's obvious dislike of Sarah, which I think can very easily be tied to her status as a scholarship or charity case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fascinating character. It's almost like she's more of the trying to rebel intellectually rather than the if we call what happens to the other girls a rebellion. It's again, as with several other elements of this film, it's tough to read. But I mean, there is the whole, you know, way that character is punished and I think by the end, you know, you can safely say abused is an unflattering element of the general situation it's presenting, which is, you know, the turn late Victorian, early 20th century mores, morals, ideas of womanhood, but also, you know, the way these ideas play up against this land that's totally unreceptive to them or inhospitable to this very buttoned up Victorian view of the world. I mean, to me, that's such the brilliant contrast in this film is you have all these characters that are behaving as if they're in an environment that they're not. This is, you know, this trip to the wild, you know, just really emphasizes the fact that they're invaders in this land. I mean, I almost wish the narration I almost wish there wasn't a line of dialogue comparing them to ants on the hill, because I find just visually the images of those girls and then the teachers on the hill, you know, a few shots after ants crawling over a piece of pastry, and the sense that each one is able, each creature you're seeing there is able to comprehend their understandings equally as well, that they may as well be ants, that they really are newcomers to this place. I mean, that to me, that's one of the most really compelling parts of this film.
Yeah, and so much of that comes out in the visual language, like as you mentioned, like not necessarily wanting it, the ants on a hill thing spelled out. Like there, mm-hmm. there's so many moments in this film where sort of the contrast between this rigid, buttoned up British Victorian quote unquote high class sensibility is contrasted against the wild landscape and Mrs. Appleyard's hair. You know, I was joking about it, but I do think that is, you know, and just her whole look is very evocative of the sensibility that these girls who disappear on the rock are literally escaping from, you know, an Appleyard, the school itself. It's just like giant, imposing, monolithic box, you know, structure and very elegant and, you know, rich looking, but contrasted next to Hanging Rock, this other giant looming monolith that is, you know, just all, again, phallic, but also just, you know, very like natural and rugged and kind of unknowable. Like you don't know where it begins and ends. It's just, it couldn't be more different from this very geometric cube of a school, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think with Sarah, I think we need a character like that to sort of ground the film in a way that none of these other characters do, that everyone else, even Mrs. Appleyard, seem symbolic in a way that Sarah isn't. Sarah, there's a complexity to that character, to her desires, for her inability to express those desires, to her situation, her social class, you know, and just like that tragic inability to pursue what she wants and to be stuck in this situation that is ultimately fatal for her, to where she can't move on, you know, and that is played in a more conventional way that gives the film a different dimension and a necessary dimension.
There's also some male characters in this film that I don't think we've brought up once.
Michael.
Maybe, Michael and also Albert, is that it? Or
his friend, or is it brother? Friend, right?
Friend, and also I believe Sarah,
servant in a way, right? I mean,
I believe a valet is the term. Albert, and also Sarah's brother. Apparently, like
that doesn't land.
A twist that you could entirely miss and has no consequence to the story at all.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like it has some third act issues that are on that front too, because it is, that does seem like a revelation that's supposed to hit harder, hit at all. I mean, you could miss it. Yeah, you could miss that fact completely.
I will admit that I don't think I would have caught it if I hadn't read the Wikipedia summary after.
Yeah, that's not a good sign. But Michael and Sarah are kind of on the same page in terms of their interest in Miranda, and just their, you know, there's kind of a obsession that both of them share. I mean, obviously Michael is late to that obsession, but he follows through on it, you know, as far as he possibly can do.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Michael, and again, I'm like trying to, you know, translate this all through the sort of allegorical nature of this film and like what each character is supposed to represent, not who they necessarily are as a character. But he's British, right? He and his family are like mm-hmm. British Army, because is it his father or his uncle? Is it a colonel?
Uncle and aunt. So I don't know what you know, I think he's really another parentless or parent, he's someone, another character removed from his parents as all the girls are.
But, you know, even just like in his dress and his, you know, top hat and tails and everything, like he feels very sort of evocative of British sort of high class chivalry, you know, whatever. There's that scene early in the film where he and Albert, you know, watch the girls cross the creek, and Albert's, you know, kind of making some lascivious comments. And
did you know, by the way, that those legs go all the way up to the bum?
Yeah, and Michael's just like, you know, a little, like he's not there for that discussion. So it feels like sort of his desire to rescue these girls is sort of born out of one to sort of bring them back to the cultural paradigm that they are escaping, you know, symbolically and literally here.
Well, I would have interpreted it a little bit differently than that, because I think what he's saying is not what he's feeling there. I think that there is, you know, an obsession and a lust, I guess, that he's sort of following through on, rather than an impulse to retrieve them from or rescue them from.
So maybe he was like trying to follow them and for whatever reason wasn't able to.
Well, I mean, just he, but he's a watcher, right? He's interested in them. It's a, you know, kind of a gazy impulse to just watch. I mean, we witnessed that in our last pairing with Rear Window. You know, you just, you know, there's an excitement to that, you know, and especially for someone who may be, you know, shy and inexperienced, but kind of, you know, showing an interest and kind of an obsession that certainly his valet does not share. Sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess he's also kind of representative of the desire for answers, you know, so that this movie doesn't fulfill either. So, it's a character like many characters in this film that I think are sort of operating on different symbolic levels.
So given how allegorical the film is, it's heavily reliant on Peter Weir's direction to bring it some life. And of course, you know, as much as this film, you know, influenced a director like Sofia Coppola, this is a film directed by a man. And, mm-hmm. and so there is that aspect to it as well. So I'm just curious what stood out to you about the style of the film, about what Peter Weir brings to the table.
Well, I mean, it's very sensual. There's a, on the Criterion channel, there's a short interview with Patton Oswalt talking about how it kind of has a soft porn look to it. I mean, though it's just sort of very soft focus and lingering over, you know, these, you know, girls in repose and so on and so forth. I mean, it doesn't go in that direction. And, you know, on the same Criterion channel feature, there's Kristen Thompson talks about how, you know, it veers into horror movie territory. Doesn't come back. There's just this all another genre, obviously driven by the gaze and looking and the voyeurism aspects of watching a movie. So, you know, but it doesn't commit to any of those. And I think that's part of what makes it such an odd film.
I already spoke about the sound of the film, which I think sort of contributes to, you know, at times the feeling that this is a little like a horror movie, but it also has, you know, a really romantic score at sometimes and a very British score at sometimes, you know, like I think it, like so much of the movie, the music is kind of operating on different levels and evoking different things at different times.
Is this where we talk about Zamfir? Is it time to talk about Zamfir, the master of the pan flute?
Oh, that's right.
I mean, everyone knows that this was the pan flute provided by George Zamfir, who is a Romanian musician who you might have been a little young to miss this, but Scott and I saw his albums. They were like advertised on television. Do you remember these, Scott? Remember Zamfir?
I'm sure it'd be like one of those like things where if I saw it, it would just bring back every possible memory of where I was, you know.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, this was, all right, for people who don't remember or were too young or whatever, on late night television, they would sell this album called Zamfir, Master of the Pan Flute, and it was just be Zamfir playing his haunting music, and it was always pretty cheesy looking, you know.
Yeah.
But
it sounds vaguely familiar. I can.
I'm sure it's on YouTube. Yeah. We can link to it or something.
Yeah, or there's probably like an SNL sketch of it or something that I've seen.
Oh, undoubtedly, it was much parodied at the time. I mean, yeah. It was the sort of, I think it was pre Susan Powder era, late infomercial. But so you know, Zamfir was a punchline for a while there. But you know, his batting average when it comes to film scores is incredible, because I love the score. I love his contributions to Ennio Morricone's score for Once Upon a Time in America. There's a passage that turns up in Kill Bill, and I've never seen it, but he did the score to The Tall Blonde Man with One Black Shoe, whatever became the Man with One Red Shoe here in the States. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think whatever cheesiness he had at that cultural moment, I think, you know, he'll most likely be remembered more for his contributions here and to a few other films than that. Or not. Maybe he just mastered the pan flute.
Another thing I wanted to bring up related to the style, and this is visual, but are either of you familiar with the detail of how Weir and his cinematographer, Russell Boyd, achieved this sort of soft, glowing look of a lot of those shots?
Yes, but why don't you tell us?
I don't know. they're
bridal veils of various thicknesses. They went into a bridal shop and ordered various pieces of wedding veil. So, you know, a very sort of practical solution, but I think I find it amusing, and I bring it up because I think, like, even on this, what would this be, a metatextual level, you know, there's symbolism happening here, sort of, yeah. with it being specifically bridal fabric and this through which we gaze at these virginal women escaping the trappings of society and whatnot. I think it's I can't go so far as to say that was like intentional, but I would guess that someone made a comment on it at some point in the filmmaking.
Yeah. Hey, wait a minute. So you've allowed all of the symbolism to just happen to be part of the equipment
yeah.
of the film. That is pretty great. Whatever they do, it does achieve a gorgeous, you know, cinematic effect. And the sound is important, and the images are just, they recall what Terrence Malick was doing at the time. I guess we would have been doing it just the once at this point, mm-hmm. right? Because Days of Heaven hadn't come out. But there is the same focus on nature, the same, you know, shots of flora and fauna, you know, that kind of give this world some verdancy in life. Those are unusual touches. And I just think there's the amount of confidence that he shows just to make a film like this as his second. I mean, I guess Sophia did hers as her first, so she's even more confident. But like this is, you know, audacious, and I think when you look at the films that he did afterwards, there's a lot of interesting similarities to how important the environment is. I mean, he's obviously an outdoorsy kind of filmmaker, but even in a movie like The Truman Show, which is, you know, environment is important in that because it's all artificial, it's all this sort of hermetic, and you long to kind of break out of it. And in here, I think it's a very inviting atmosphere, as much as it is filled with danger, and as many people who die and disappear in this movie, the atmosphere of the film itself is not uninviting. And there are times when it just is painterly. I mean, those shots of the schoolgirls and the teachers with their little umbrellas on the at the base of the rock, you know, sort of lounging around. I mean, you just could put that in a museum, right? It's like so gorgeous.
I mean, I gather that they were explicitly inspired by Australian Impressionism for the visual look of this. There's even, again, going back to the Wikipedia page, which I promise I read things other than the Wikipedia page about this movie.
They're just other stuff.
Yeah, they're just all collected there. But mm-hmm. to the point that there is like actually a picture of a painting by Frederick McCubbin, an Australian Impressionist, to sort of illustrate what was the visual inspiration here. Mm.
So we're really bearing down into the small details here. So why don't we hold off and talk a little bit more later about Picnic at Hanging Rock next week in relation to The Dry, and move on to feedback. Now it's time for feedback, where we answer any questions and respond to any comments about our episodes or anything else in the world of film. First up is an email from Eric from New Brunswick, Canada, about the threat to physical media. Genevieve, do you want to take this one?
Sure. Eric writes, as someone who loves going to movies, I've certainly been part of the chorus pining for the post-pandemic return of the theater-going experience. But as someone who also likes collecting movies, I've been troubled with how the ever-increasing focus on streaming services appears to be taking a toll on the production of physical media. Whether it's produced for streaming films like The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and I'm thinking of Ending Things, that don't appear to have DVD Blu-ray versions in their immediate future, or theatrically released favorites from the last year like The Empty Man or Saint Maud that are only parked dropped on the streamers, the inevitability of a film getting a physical release seems increasingly inevitable. I'm curious if any of you have been or are still currently maintaining movie collections, and even if you aren't, if you have any feelings about the film archive becoming ever more ephemeral. Keith?
We definitely have feelings, Eric. Thank you for teeing this one up.
Yeah, sure. I was actually just looking to see if there is a Blu-ray of St. Maud, and is, but not for Region 1. And the fact that I'm talking about Region 1 probably answers your question. Like, yes, I do still maintain a film collection. There was a period in the height of the DVD era when, like, it was a movie that I liked, I would buy it, you know, and I don't do that anymore. But also that was an era in which movies that came out of any significance usually had, you know, felt like you were buying like the critical edition of something with all kinds of extra supplementary stuff. And it was, you weren't just getting the film, you were getting like sort of a way to study the film, and that that appealed. But I look for any excuse to buy for as part of work. I will buy a Blu-ray at the merest need. I'm waiting to upgrade my, you know, we toyed with doing a Shining episode a little while ago, and I was like, oh, you know, I probably will need the 4K edition of that before I could watch it again. You know, you can't watch it anything but the most optimal format available. But no, I think it's important though. I mean, I at some point my collection became too big for shelves, so I have a fairly selective bit there. But I kept all the pamphlets, but I threw away most of the cases and filed the discs away in a couple of suitcase like trunks that I use all the time. I mean, I find it completely invaluable to have that kind of thing. But I think you're right that you know, the era of inevitable physical media releases is over. I think with the Netflix deal, we're lucky that a few like the Scorsese films and the Quran and Roma and a few other Netflix things are getting releases through Criterion, but that just seems like kind of a special sweetheart deal kind of thing. So I'd say collect them while you can. I forget at one point, Oliver Stone, who is never wrong about anything, obviously, talked about Blu-rays as the you know, get them while you can, because it's the last physical format that you're gonna have. So I'm all for that. I miss and you know, we're going to do a whole episode on ways streaming services are work and don't work for people who love movies, but
you that's know, on the Patreon.
Yes,
right.
What a reason to subscribe.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, certainly you can romanticize it, and you kind of forget all the ways they were pains in the asses. But you know, there's something about a video store that wasn't beholden to rights. Like, you know, imagine a video store where you could only get Disney films. It wouldn't last very long. But now that's kind of the situation we're in with these streaming services, where you kind of have to go from service to service to get what you want. And I don't know. I think there's some downsides to that. Let's just leave it there.
Yeah, I mean, you're paying for visitation rights on a lot of this stuff. I mean, if it just exists, as Eric says, if the Ballad of Buster Scruggs or I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which are films by major filmmakers, mm-hmm. just exist on Netflix, or the Bash Brothers Experience, talking about, I was like thinking about, why am I even subscribing to Netflix? Oh yeah, I need visitation rights to the Bash Brothers Experience. You know,
for when you need to shake four halves of butt.
Yeah. What an incredible line. Ah, so good. It's been silk robes and kimonos for me all week long singing that song. Anyway, but I mean, and it's been extremely encouraging to see Netflix collaborate with Criterion on some of its major releases, just because it's like springing it from jail, these films. Like, these films can now exist in physical form. Nobody can control them, take them away, you know, demand X amount of money per month for you to have visitation rights. You know, and then the format is better. Blu-ray is still a superior format to streaming, you know, I mean, whether you care that much about the difference between the two is obviously an open question. But I lament it, and you know, and I'm part of that. You know, I'm to blame for the diminishment of physical media. I do buy films on occasion, and get asked for films as gifts and get. But there was a time, you know, when I was at the AV Club and at the Dissolve, when we were just on that kind of gravy mm-hmm. train, right? And getting all of those Criterions and Shout Factory releases. And so I amassed this huge collection, you know, that I have entirely in my in a filing system in my garage. I'm not even done filing yet, which much to the chagrin.
Are you 10 years in this project at this point?
Yeah,
Scott?
Unfortunately, I am. But it's very hard to, like, I do all that.
I bared down and finished mine during the pandemic. It was
yeah,
good.
But you know. You're very good with the stick-to-itiveness and the drive, and me, I just get kind of lazy. But
I will say this: there is a little bit where the ones that are still around are really good. Like Criterion remains excellent, and I'm happy to remain on their mailing list.
And they're still doing
great discs.
A lot of special features, and they're making doing a lot. And Shout Factory as well. So
Shout Factory is great, Arrow, which is a British company, but their stuff is distributed here, is also really good.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it all comes down to it,
KL Studio Classics, Kino, also
we can
great.
Talk about. But I mean, one of these things have in common. I think we're also seeing, this is a larger discussion we can't get into now, but we're seeing with theaters that are coming back, I think there's a huge niche that exists now for physical media and for, you know, art house films and that sort of thing. But they're very strong, you know, they're very devoted. They're not going to move right, and that makes a difference. That's how records exist.
Yeah, I was going to say Blu-rays are like the 180 gram vinyl reissues now. Yep.
Which
know?
Vinyl outsold, was it CDs that last year? Like vinyl was like the most popular physical music form in 2020 or something like that.
But I still have CDs. I just bought a CD player for the first time in a while off of Craigslist.
A CD player, Keith. How about that? What and cassettes? What about, how are you doing with the cassettes? Are you bringing those back?
No, but I do. A couple years ago, I was at a garage sale and I was like, wow, that's a sweet cassette deck, and I got it for $5, and I got it home and was like, well, what am I going to do with the sweet cassette deck?
Anyways, but yeah.
I think like vinyl, Blu-ray, you know, still has a future, although it may be a more sort of, you know, boutique experience, you know, like your Criterions and your Kino Lorber. And it's not a, you know, a given that any film will get a release, but I think we will continue to get physical releases of films, but they will probably be in this more like, quote unquote, special context, you know, not so much the CBS bin of $2 DVD thing as much.
Yeah.
But, and you know, I'm kind of sad about that, but also as someone who does not maintain a physical media collection, or at least a physical film collection, I do have a lot of vinyl. Like I also feel kind of hypocritical, like bemoaning it, you know, like it is a bummer that something like, I don't know, did Palm Springs, that's like a film that I like and might want to rewatch. Did that get a physical release? Probably not, you know? So like, yeah, it's a little bit of a bummer, but also like, I'm not a person who rewatches films a whole lot. You know, so I think I tend to think of buying physical forms of movies as more of like an archival project. And here is where I will go back to a point I have made on the podcast several times before, is that libraries exist and you should use them. And they very often have amazing physical media collections. I remember when we did what was the Cassavetes film we did a couple years
back? Killing of a Chinese Bookie?
Yeah. When we did Killing of a Chinese Bookie, like that's out of print, you know, like we almost didn't do it because it was going to be hard for people to see. It's not streaming anywhere. And I you know, not producing new DVDs of it, but they had it at my, you know, local suburban Michigan library, which has a huge room of floor to ceiling full of DVDs and Blu-rays. And it was, I think, you know, seeing that room for the first time, because I just recently moved to Michigan, it was like, oh, the video store experience still exists. You know, you just have to kind of want to go and get it in this slightly different context. But, you know, I hope everyone out there has access to a collection as nice as the one at the Canton Public Library.
I mean, that's my cinephile origin story, is going to watch movies at the seventh floor of the University of Georgia library, videotapes and laser discs. And, you know, I mean, again, it was just all kind of classics, but just a massive collection. And it's nice to see that, tradition.
And they're not just continues. Classics either. Like I think like there are still people who don't stream, you know, and there are people who don't have like computers. That's why the libraries have like computers that people can come in and use, you know, like it's an increasingly smaller part of the population, but there is, you know, there are parents out there maybe who want to like show their kids the latest Minions movie and don't want to do it on Amazon so they can go to the library and rent it. You know, it's not all highfalutin, you know, cinema archival stuff.
Well, I hope that, I hope for Eric's sake that there's a fine library in New Brunswick.
For everyone's sake.
Yes, for everyone's sake. Well, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response in a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at The Dry, another Australian film about a rural community reshaped by mystery and loss. Look for that episode next Tuesday, or you can subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. If you want to hear it without ads, and while surrounded by extra Next Picture Show written and recorded content, come support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. Find us at nextpictureshow.net and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, I'm going to strap myself to the permanent posture improver until I can finally sit up straight. It didn't hurt.